Hello and welcome. I'm Renee Kemp, sitting in for Rose Aguilar. And this is Your Calls Friday Media Roundtable. Look forward to it all week because we get to touch on the news stories of the week. We're going to start with a review of President Trump's declaration of emergency and the diversion of billions of dollars to build his border wall. The question, will media cover this as political theater or as a potentially dangerous power grab for the executive branch of government? And what can Democrats do about it? Also, Minnesota Congresswoman Ilhan Omar's one-line simple tweet about AIPAC. The American Israel Public Affairs Committee has set off a firestorm that's lasted the entire news week. So how does media cover that powerful lobbying group and other lobbying groups by comparison? And later we're going to examine Governor Gavin Newsom's State of the State address and look at his vision and the direction in which he would like to take the state. We're going to be joined for the first portion of the program, hopefully by Paul Blumenthal, who's going to be joining us from the Huffington Post. But first we go to Eli Clifton. Eli is a reporting fellow at Type Media Center. He covers politics and U.S. foreign policy. And he's also a contributing editor at Loblog. Eli Clifton, hi, good morning. Happy Friday.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Excellent. You know, we're going to start off with you and then pick Paul up a little bit later. We were going to go in a different direction to start the show, but hopefully you have in mind some reporting that stuck out in your mind this week. Do you have kudos for any reporting in particular that you came across this week?
Well, there are two pieces, and one of them I think probably ties into the topic we'll be discussing later about Ilhan Omar's tweets about AIPAC and the special interest influences over U.S. foreign policy. But the first I would point to is a phenomenal and fascinating New Yorker feature piece by Adam Entis and Ronan Farrow. I believe the title of it was A Private Mossad for Hire. And it profiles what is probably one of possibly many private consultancies that hire former spies, in this case from the Israeli Mossad, to work on campaigns, political ones, business research, and something that we're increasingly gaining greater insights into, and possibly a business that's actually growing at the same time, following the Harvey Weinstein case where he hired Black Cube, again, another one of these contractors based in Israel. In this case, the one that they look at is called the Psy Group, which did research and actual campaign electioneering work related activities on a hospital board race in California, and showing how both the growth of social media, the capacity to influence it, perhaps people's awareness of how much impact you can have through social media influence following the 2016 election, has led to this growth in an industry of former intelligence officers, contractors who are offering their services to pretty much anybody who's willing to pay what are actually rather low sums of money, considering the results that they offer to deliver to their clients.
And there is nothing barring them. There's nothing illegal about it, right?
There's nothing that appears to be illegal about it, and it should raise concerns about, in my mind in reading it, both obviously the growth of this industry in a totally unregulated way, which is going to be a hard thing to address through any legal mechanism because it's a global industry and it operates on a global scale through the internet mostly, but also the heightened risk and influence of social media in ways that we had never conceptualized until, for many of us, until really the 2016 election. So I think it's a fascinating read from a number of perspectives. The other thing I would point to is the Wall Street Journal today just did a profile on AIPAC and how it exerts influence in Washington through the junkets it takes lawmakers on, through the campaign contributions that it doesn't make, but that it encourages its members to make, and the history of that influence and its role in Washington. It's really fascinating and something that I really don't think you would have seen a year ago, maybe not even a month ago, and I think it's clearly a result of the conversation that Representative Ilhan Omar helped start.
Boy, is there a lot to cover on that subject. That's actually where we were going to start our discussion, and we're certainly going to jump back on that again shortly. But because the president made that speech today, I kind of wanted to start off there. So, okay, last night, Thursday night, Congress passes a government funding bill. It does not include anything more than $1.375 billion for Trump's wall, which is not just less than the 5.7 that he was asking for, but considerably less than the almost $25 billion that Trump could have had if he had gone for the legislation that was on the table last year. So, okay, that's Thursday night. Congress passes the government funding bill to avoid a shutdown. Doesn't include wall funding. Here we are, Friday morning. President Trump comes out to the Rose Garden and declares a state of national emergency at the southern U.S. border, because that's what it says. Basically, there's a state of national emergency going on at our southern border. It's an attempt to unilaterally seize funding so that he can begin building that long-promised wall. So, okay. First, let's talk about that speech, shall we, Eli? I was thinking, you know, anyone who wrote the speech or who coached him would have said, if we're going to make the case that this is truly an emergency, we've got to, you know, make the case and make it strongly. Instead, he starts by talking about the U.S. economy, how strong it is, and North Korea and nuclear talks. And by the way, when he was referring to his conversation with Chinese President Xi, did I detect that he was kind of mocking the way President Xi talked, the way he spoke? It just sounded almost like he was mocking the way, you know, a Chinese president would talk. It just seemed strange to me in a lot of ways. And then he finally gets to his reasoning behind the border wall. And I had this vision of fact checkers going crazy because he threw out a lot of numbers. But overall, how do you think journalists are going to cover this departure from normal, this declaration of an emergency? Do you think they're going to cover it as this is a constitutional end run around Congress? Or is it going to be the political theater of, here we go again, it's Trump versus Nancy?
I think both of those can be true. I think that certainly one way I've seen it discussed widely is that this is a constitutional end run, but not just a constitutional end run, it's also a Hail Mary and not a very passionate one. As you just said, if he was really going to try to sell this idea of a state of emergency, one that I personally don't agree with, and I think a lot of other people would say it's probably just factually not a situation we're facing, but if you want to try to make that case, you're going to have to lead with that in the speech, and you're going to have to make the most terrifying paint the most terrifying picture you can. And he's actually made, I think, more passionate arguments about the dangers of the southern border in the most xenophobic and terrifying ways in the past. I don't think this was really one of them, and it's kind of odd because this is the moment when he really had to make that case. He didn't do it. So at the same time, yes, this is going to become another example of a showdown where it's, I guess, between him and Nancy Pelosi, or Chuck and Nancy, as he likes to put it.
Mm-hmm.
I think that the narrative is going to be that they've basically beaten him, and now he's willing to try to test this with the Justice Department and with the courts, where I think there probably will be some opposition put up about the concept of a national security being invoked so he can make a grab for public monies that he wasn't able to successfully negotiate for. As you pointed out, he probably got less out of this deal than what he could have gotten, and now he's making a rather desperate play. So I think that the narrative so far that I've seen, and I think it's rather early to draw the conclusion about where the spin cycle is headed, but it's that this is a rather desperate play, and it's one of a president who has lost on one of his biggest gambits. And I think it's also worth reflecting for a moment that the border wall was never that big a part of his original campaign. The story about why he started to talk about build the wall at campaign rallies is that he was told by someone, hey, this is an interesting thing to say. It has a ring to it. Why don't you try it? And the first few times he said, I'm not going to say that. That doesn't sound very good. Then he said it, and he was impressed by the way the crowd responded. There was no discussion or policy basis for it to start with. It was purely that he was surprised by how the crowd reacted. He liked how the crowd reacted, and he kept doing it. And now flash forward to where we are now, where we've now gone through a government shutdown. he's probably gotten less out of his budget negotiations than he could have gotten otherwise, because he was dead set on the wall, because he believes that his base demands it, which might be true, although his base is shrinking somewhat. The people that are hardcore supporters of his do prioritize this. And this is where we're at. This is all he's trying to cling to in salvaging somehow something resembling a win out of what's been probably his biggest legislative disaster to date.
But I kind of think, Eli, like, is he performing some kind of Jedi mind trick? I was looking at those posters at the El Paso rally this week that said, finish the wall. So he says, oh no, we've already started it. It's just about finishing it. When factually we know that is not the case. So I'm just thinking, and yet it's working, because they started the chant, finish that wall, finish that wall. How is the media able to deal with that kind of change in message when it looks like it's that train has already left the station? The finish the wall train has left the station already.
I have no doubt that by the time the 2020 election rolls around, he's going to be touting his great success in building the wall. Whether or not he's even able to get any funding for it through the state of emergency, he certainly isn't going to have a completed border wall by 2020. And I'm sure he will try to claim that he has done so. There's nothing we can do about that. I think the media does try to call him out on it. And I would point back to, again, sort of the base of people at these rallies who responded positively to the build the wall are probably the ones that are going to believe when he's holding his campaign rallies that he actually delivered on it. Reality and the facts seem to not hold too much value to some of the president's closest, most consistent and ardent supporters.
Again, it's a challenge for journalists, because on some level, you have to not just take what's happened today, but kind of go back and give it some historical reference. So how much of the GOP strategy and the president's strategy on this relies on public ignorance of the Constitution, the fact that, no, it's the Congress that appropriates money? The president can't just go and take money from one place and another and create monies for a pet project. That's not what the Constitution says. I mean, are reporters reduced to giving the public civics lessons now?
Well, yes, I think that increasingly that is the role of journalists, is offering an explanation for all the things that civics class should have covered, because this president is testing all of those lessons very, very hard. I think one thing that certainly does come up repeatedly here, though, and something that I think runs counter to that narrative, that the president is able to sort of run his own narrative about how we have an emergency and now he's going to grab this money because he couldn't get it in negotiations, is that he went into the budget negotiations with Chuck and Nancy, as he likes to say, very prominently discussing how he was such a great negotiator and how he was going to reach out to them and how they would do a great deal and how he was certain that because of his superior intellect and superior negotiating techniques and the art of the deal, that he could make this happen. Now, regardless of how you feel about the border wall, regardless, honestly, about how you feel about Donald Trump, it's kind of hard to see what's happened as the art of the deal or the great negotiator at work. Now we're seeing somebody who's engaged in, as I say, sort of an end run around the legislative process.
It seems to me that so far the Democrats' argument has been a little bit lame. It's been, wait till we get in office, when the Democratic president has his priorities and wants to declare an emergency around guns or the environment, then you'll be sorry. But, you know, in two words, all I could think was Merrick Garland. They're not worried about a day when maybe somewhere down the road Democrats might get in power, because they'll just shut it down the way they did with Merrick Garland. So, you know, my thinking, Eli, is that it might be that the real pushback might come when these stories start getting covered by local news. You know, just like the government shutdown was this big amorphous issue on the national news, but then when local news stations started saying, wait a minute, this local government entity is being affected by the shutdown, and this is your neighbor who's at a food bank now. So when Virginia Senator Ten Kaine went on the air today on NPR and said, look, there's a project to upgrade housing for military families because there's black mold and damaged roofs in my district, in my state, that are going to be affected if the president takes this money. To what extent do you think local news is going to carry the water for the Democrats on making the case against this potential power grab?
Well, I think in the case that you just pointed to, of with the government shutdown, it wasn't just the local news; it was the local impact that people could see and feel of the government shutdown. And remember, it was within 24 hours. I think it was within 12 hours of what appeared to be a shutdown at LaGuardia's airport because of air traffic controllers and various other federally government regulated and overseen entities. That the impact of that shutdown was clearly about to become a nationwide event. It wasn't just going to be LaGuardia. It was going to be other airports. And the discussion turned to that this is going to snowball really fast. And within 12 hours of that, my recollection, the president agreed to at that point, put together a temporary funding agreement to reopen the government. So I'm curious, as we look toward the state of emergency, how that's going to impact local communities in ways that people can feel it. I think that's going to rely a lot more on the media and on, frankly, on politicians and the media to explain why this is wrong and why this runs counter to what a good fiscal policy would look like for this country.
Well, as I said, Eli, we had to kind of take a bit of a turn in how we were going to structure the show because of this declaration this morning. So I'm glad you had some time to think about where you think the media is going to go in terms of this coverage. It gave us a chance to bring in Paul Blumenthal. Hi, we're joined by Paul Blumenthal. He covers money and politics at the Huffington Post, and he's in D.C. Hi, thanks for being here, Paul.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
Yeah, you bet. I know you've had a chance, I guess, to listen to the emergency declaration. Did you have any thoughts before we go on to our next subject?
I think if you've already talked about this, I anticipate that this is going to wind up in the courts, and, it's going to be another fight for Donald Trump, a lot more tweets about how he doesn't like the Ninth Circuit. And maybe he might wind up not liking the Supreme Court justices that he appointed.
And it's likely to end up in his favorite court, the Ninth Circuit. We know how much he loves it.
Yeah, he's tweeted repeatedly about how much he hates the Ninth Circuit. Mm-hmm. It's been a long-time Republican talking point opposed to the Ninth Circuit, which has been, had a progressive majority for quite some time. There have been proposals to break it up. Some states with Republican governors have sought to withdraw from it, and Donald Trump has entertained some of those theories. Whether he fully understands, what the actual policy ramifications of that is undetermined.
Okay, guys, let's move on. Money in politics. This week's story is all about a pair of tweets that have taken on a life of their own and created a huge surge in media attention. A few days ago on Twitter, Minnesota Congresswoman Ilhan Omar suggested that the Republican attacks on her and on Michigan Representative Rashida Tlaib were, quote, all about the Benjamins, baby. That one-line tweet has touched off a real firestorm. Her suggestion was that money heavily influences politicians' positions on Israel. And when asked who she was talking about, she specifically named AIPAC, the American Israel Public Affairs Committee, the powerful pro-Israel lobbying group. And then it really started to get a lot of attention from both Republicans and Democrats. So, Paul, since you're just joining us, how do you explain the amount of attention that this is getting?
Well, obviously this is, one of the most hot button issues, third rail kind of issues in American politics. Unlike in Israel, actually, it seems like you can't level any kind of criticism about Israel or its efforts to influence policy in the United States. So it doesn't surprise me at all that this blew up in the way that it did. What is actually the case is that supporters of Israel in the United States, not just Israel, but support, you know, Americans who support Israel, organized together to lobby in support of Israel. These are, you know, people who support the foreign state of Israel. They're pro-Israel. They hire lobbyists. It's, you know, like any other enterprise that we see or lobbying effort, that's what they're doing. And, you know, they spend millions of dollars every year through APAC, which is the American Israel
Public Affairs Committee.
Public Affairs Committee, yes, thank you. So it's not a political action committee. It does not, the entity itself does not donate money directly to candidates. So it's mostly a lobbying enterprise. And through that, its members organize to give donations to candidates. And so, I mean, this is an influence lobby. It's something that does exist in Washington, D.C., in the United States writ large. And it has, you know, been around for decades. This has a long history. Back in the 1950s, the American Jewish Council, which was one, or the American Zionist Council, which was one of the original Israel lobby organizations, was forced to register as a foreign agent. Began to be investigated in the 1950s, and then it ramped up as being required to register as a foreign agent lobbying for Israel under the Kennedy and Lyndon Johnson administrations. And because of that, that organization kind of folded, and APAC took its place, keeping a distance from Israel while basically having Americans run it. And so that was a way to sort of get legal under the Foreign Agent Registration Act and be just like a domestic lobbying organization. So that's the history behind it. It's a real thing. It exists like any other lobbying enterprise in Washington that spends, you know, $3.5 million, I believe, in the previous year on lobbyists to influence Washington in a pro-Israel direction.
So I wasn't aware that APAC does not directly give money. It's others, donors like Sheldon Adelson, who actually give money, but APAC does not. Is that right?
So APAC itself as an entity, it has no political action committee. It always its spokespeople will say, we do not give money. From what I have learned from, you know, people I know who've worked on the Hill, who've dealt with APAC's lobbying efforts, how it works, is, you know, APAC has about 100,000 members throughout the United States. And basically, who are part of a program that, you know, chooses to donate to candidates. And how it works is they have a few members in each congressional district who organize fundraisers, who contribute maximum amounts of money to their congressmen. And so those are the point people for a lot of the lobbying that happens. So, you know, it's very much structured like a traditional American grassroots association, which, you know, we have lots of in American politics. It's part of our democratic tradition. But, you know, they very much use the ability to fundraise, the campaign contributions from people in the congressional districts to gain meetings, to gain trust with members of Congress, to be able to push the, you know, this pro-Israel sort of never question Israel agenda in a way that the other side, you know, if this debate is between Israelis and Palestinians, the Palestinians do not have anything remotely close to this lobbying Washington organized American citizens giving campaign contributions. You know, it's just the imbalance is immeasurable.
I'm not sure that there's anything that that even begins to approach or equal the kind of power that this particular PAC has. If you're just joining us, we're with Paul Blumenthal of the Huffington Post, and Eli Clifton is with us as well. We're going to take a quick break and come right back. Stay with us.
Your call is better when you get involved, and if you have a question, idea, or experience to contribute to today's conversation, give us a call here at the station at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK, toll free. You can also send an email to yourcall@kalw.org or leave a comment at the show's website. Set a bookmark for yourcallradio.org. You can also tweet us at yourcallradio. And at 11 o'clock, we'll have 1A with Joshua Johnson here on 91.7 KALW.
Welcome back. For those of you just joining us, I'm Renee Kemp, sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call's Friday Media Roundtable. We are podcasting the show. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org. You can also listen to past shows there and sign up for our newsletter to find out about what's coming up next. If you have a show idea, drop us a line at yourcall@kalw.org. Or give us a call, 866-798-8255, or leave a comment on the website, yourcallradio.org. Coming up on the next call, Your Call One Planet series, listen for journalist Todd Miller. He'll be discussing his book, Storming the Wall, Climate Change, Migration, and Homeland Security. Experts are predicting that a person is more likely to be displaced by environmental forces than by war. And without some kind of global legal framework on climate, the question is what to do with the plight of climate refugees. So join the conversation on Monday's Your Call with Rose Aguilar. Today, we are talking with Eli Clifton of Type Media Center. He covers politics and U.S. foreign policy. And also Paul Blumenthal, who covers money and politics at the Huffington Post. And we're talking about the power of lobbies on Congress, and particularly the power of AIPAC. Eli, talk to us about why AIPAC has turned out to be such a third rail when it comes to coverage in U.S. media. Paul made the case that it's likely not to have been such a big deal when Minnesota Congresswoman Ilhan Omar suggested it's all about the Benjamins when it comes, or money, rather, when it comes to the impact on policy in Congress. Money in politics and Israeli lobbyist groups. Paul seems to think that in Israel it would not have had the effect that it's had here in the United States. Why is AIPAC off limits? Why is that third rail?
Well, I think that there's a couple of reasons. And certainly one of them is a sensitivity about criticizing a group that wants to portray itself as representing Jewish Americans. And in there lies one of the reasons that there's now a growing tension, is that growing numbers of especially young Jews are less sympathetic to Israel than they might have been 10 or 20 years ago. And on top of that, within the Democratic Party, there is a growing unease with sort of the bipartisan consensus about being unconditionally pro-Israel and having no daylight between the United States and Israel. And as that tension grows, there's a growing effort to try to, a necessary effort to try to stifle any debate or discussion about the U.S.-Israel relationship, because there's a good chance that as those tensions continue to grow, that the outcome might not be good for AIPAC or for especially sort of the right wing in Israel led by Benjamin Netanyahu's Likud party. So a way to do that is to try to make the cost very high for any politician that grabs onto what you described as this third rail of American politics. I don't think it would have been considered a third rail even 20 or 30 years ago, but it's become this taboo issue precisely because the discussion of it is now much more loaded and a much more dangerous topic, specifically for AIPAC and the other vested interests who have managed to really, really, really control this debate around Israel. And now I think Ilhan Omar and her comments, the interesting thing is that in doing so, she did exactly what these groups want to avoid. It's a member of Congress saying it, and on top of that, the response to her saying this has been both certainly people attacking her for doing it, as well as people saying, why can't we talk about this? Why is this a third rail? This is American foreign policy. And that's the final thing I would point to, is that it goes beyond U.S.-Israel relationship, it has to do about with how we talk about U.S. foreign policy. That the so-called blob, as Benjamin Rhodes referred to it, is this entity in Washington that is bipartisan. It's made up of think tankers as well as politicians that creates and it reinforces sort of the so-called consensus thinking on foreign policy. To challenge that, of which AIPAC is a part, and to challenge components of it, such as the U.S.-Israel relationship, is threatening to this group of people, where there is less policy debate and less meaningful competition as there is in other policy areas. Any other policy area you can find, I think you'll find a more vibrant debate than that which goes on around foreign policy, specifically in the Middle East. And the fact that this was just opened up and laid bare for anybody who's paying attention right now to the media cycle is a fascinating moment, and one which is, as I say, very dangerous for a number of the vested interests here.
And, you know, it seems to me that this is a good opportunity to kind of pull this out and talk about it, that there is often a conflating of criticism of Israel with anti-Semitism. Paul, can you talk about the extent to which that happens a lot?
I mean, certainly that's, as Eli just mentioned, you know, I mean, that's sort of part of this public relations campaign, essentially, you know, by pro-Israel forces here in America, Americans, and the Israeli government, who aren't necessarily working hand in hand, but they have similar interests. And one of those interests is to maintain strong U.S. ties and ensuring that the U.S. government continues to back Israel to the hilt, you know, unquestioning. You know, you saw even with, you know, Barack Obama had claims against him that he was anti-Israel. He was very unpopular in Israel itself, terribly low approval ratings for how he treated Israel, even though, I mean, he was no differently pro-Israel than Bill Clinton or George W. Bush.
So why the animus, do you think?
I mean, I think that the animus in some ways stems from, for Obama, he did do some outreach to the Arab world. He was talking about a two-state solution in a way that has now, I mean, politics in Israel have changed so much since, you know, Bill Clinton brought Yasser Arafat and Yitzhak Rabin together in the Rose Garden of the White House to shake hands. You know, the right wing in Israel, a far right winger, assassinated Rabin, and the people who support his politics are, you know, pretty much ascendant in that country. Donald Trump has a 69% approval rating in Israel. You know, he's the most, that's the place where he's the most popular in the world.
But why? You know what? That's what I don't understand. During the presidential campaign, Republicans used anti-Semitic imagery to attack Hillary Clinton. Remember the online ad with the Star of David? There's a long list of white nationalists who have supported the Trump administration. There's Sebastian Gorka, you know, wearing the insignia on his lapel. In support, apparently, that's what the insignia means, of a Nazi collaboration regime. I mean, you have them like McCarthy, the minority leader, saying, you know, we can't allow Soros and Steyer and Bloomberg to buy this election, implying what? That somehow Jews are financing the left. So why is it that the Trump administration seems to be able to duck the anti-Semitic label when there's all this evidence that there are anti-Semites who support him? Eli, do you have a thought on that?
Well, I think it's pretty clear that there is now an implicit or maybe an explicit agreement that's been made that you can be anti-Semitic and you can say anti-Semitic things as long as you don't criticize Israel or Benjamin Netanyahu's policies. And that's something we're getting to see play out on nearly a daily basis now with Republicans who are verging further and further to the right. It's not just Donald Trump. And they are simply immune to that criticism from the same people who would attack Ilhan Omar for daring to raise the possibility that AIPAC plays some role in influencing U.S. foreign policy. I would also point to the fact that the Republican Party's biggest donor at this point, and Donald Trump's biggest donor, Sheldon Adelson, makes it pretty clear that advancing a far-right agenda for Israel, advancing the likelihood of war with Iran, he's suggested deploying a nuclear weapon against Iran, are simply his top priorities. He's Jewish, and obviously he's also willing to look the other way as the Republican Party and as Donald Trump and his supporters, and in many cases Trump's own advisors, have now been dog whistling, if not making more explicit overtures to anti-Semites.
So that kind of support from Sheldon Adelson has inoculated them from any anti-Semitic charges. Is that right?
I don't even think it's his support that inoculates him. I think he's following along with this obvious tacit agreement of allying with people who are expressing anti-Semitic views in order to advance a far-right pro-Israel agenda in Israel.
I think it's also worth adding on to that the fact that, you know, the largest pro-Israel community in the United States and the base of the Republican Party are Christian evangelicals. They're not even Jews.
Yes.
And, you know, these are people who, you know, the underlying eschatology of their support in their religion is for the apocalypse to come once Israel is established, greater Israel as it was in the Bible, and then the apocalypse can come. And they can go to heaven when Jesus comes back, and the Jews will be left, you know, on earth with the devil.
I think that's very important that Christian evangelical support for Israel is unwavering. And I think you're right. I think that that leads to a lot of the support for Trump that you wouldn't otherwise expect. 866-798-8255 is the number if you have anything that you'd like to add to the discussion today. We're talking about powerful lobbying groups in Washington, AIPAC and others. Also about the president's declaration of emergency today, whatever news stories strike you. 866-798-8255 is the number. Let's go to Lisa in San Francisco. Hi, Lisa. Thanks for holding on.
Thank you. I'd like to also just start out with to tie in those two things together. First of all, very few people know that one of the major companies getting a lot of millions of dollars to surveil the border, the Arizona border, is Elbit Systems, Israeli contractor. So there's a lot of money coming from the United States to Israel in many different forms. And also, I would really strongly recommend to your listeners to look at YouTube under David Sheen. He's an Israeli journalist who did an incredible presentation regarding called Israeli Politics Decoded, which identifies what exactly Israel is today, what kind of government Israel is today. It should be noted that that Israel has supported via weapon sales the neo-Nazi groups in the Ukraine, the Serbian genocide, the Guatemalan Rios Montt government, which killed 100,000 indigenous people in Guatemala, and also Pinochet in Chile. So this whole accusation of anti-Semitism, in reality, the ones who are claiming that, I would say that would be more anti-Semitic to claim that Israel has any relationship to Judaism whatsoever. That would be anti-Semitic, in my view. The other thing also is that the main reason why Ilhan Omar has been attacked was because she supports BDS. And just to think about the level of power that AIPAC has on our government, that more than 26 states already have passed anti-BDS laws, meaning our First Amendment rights have been completely violated. Our First Amendment rights to peacefully boycott apartheid has been completely violated. Meanwhile, my tax money, $30 billion of our tax money is going to Israel. So that's the power of AIPAC.
Thank you, Lisa, from San Francisco. For those views, BDS, of course, is the is the movement designed to defund monies from Israel. You know, she makes a good point that in apologizing for sending out the tweets, and Congresswoman Omar has apologized over and over and over again And yet she stood by her view that lobbyists' money is paying too big, it's just too big a role in American politics. So I'm just wondering, though, it seems to me that it used to be that there were other third rail issues. It was abortion or it was guns. How is it that coverage of AIPAC differs so differently, so much from, say, coverage of NRA issues? Paul, you want to take that one?
I mean, the thing that makes it so different is that it's almost like you have to, you're required to pretend it doesn't exist. I mean, AIPAC often makes the argument that, you know, they have no power, all these hundreds of thousands of members, millions of dollars spent lobbying, countless campaign contributions made by their members, the millions of dollars they spend on lavish trips for congressional members and staff to go to Israel and hear from Israeli lawmakers. You know, and then they claim that none of this is here. You know, don't, there isn't even a wizard in front of the curtain, let alone behind it. You know, this is invisible. We're supposed to pretend that they have no power at all. I mean, this was what happened when Stephen Walt and John Mearsheimer, the scholars, wrote their book called The Israel Lobby. We had the same exact argument that we're having over Ilhan Omar, except it was mostly about there is no Israel lobby, was the argument against the book. You know,
there just
I think
is
that
no
Omar,
such thing, right? That was
yeah,
the argument?
This does not exist, you know. Mm-hmm. You know, that you're in the Matrix, that this is, you know, there. this is not a thing that is real when, you know, you can see it with your own eyes.
And I would also add on that AIPAC actually advertises that they have their congressional club, which is for members who give, I believe it's $2,500 in campaign contributions every year. Now that's admittedly not AIPAC giving those campaign contributions, but it is them signaling that they will put their members on a pedestal who give pro-Israel, as they describe it, campaign contributions. I also just wanted to briefly add on that it's not just financial links between Israel and, for instance, the DHS spending on the border. There's also an ideological link there, and if anything, sort of a public relations link that you see Donald Trump and other Republicans regularly talking about how walls work, and their example is, look at Israel, look at Israel's Gaza border and their Gaza fence, look at how many supposed terrorists that they claim to have stopped because of it, and that's all the proof you need. And then that's sort of been a self-fulfilling echo chamber, as it were, because you also see then Benjamin Netanyahu also echoing that back.
He mentioned it today, yeah.
Right. So it's become sort of this a self-reinforcing phenomenon that as Israel tilts further to the right, you also see the American right using that to affirm whatever policies they are also pursuing.
You know, Congresswoman Ilhan Omar has been apologizing like crazy. But, you know, I'm really starting to wonder if this was not something that she actually stumbled into, but rather something that she did intentionally to open this difficult conversation, because it seemed to me that when we saw her again this week confronting Elliot Abrams, who President Trump has chosen to advise him on Venezuela, she called out Abrams on his very dark past, that back in the 80s he oversaw involvement in Latin America, including the support for the Guatemalan dictator who butchered people, the cover-up in El Salvador of the thousands of, or hundreds rather, of people who were killed at El Mozote, and the fact that Elliot Abrams received a pardon from George H.W. Bush in the Iran-Contra affair. You know, I thought when I watched her, I thought she has not been chastened one little bit by this whole discussion of AIPAC this week. So do you think that this was intentional, Eli, in an attempt to kind of break open this discussion about AIPAC? Or do you think she really did kind of stumble backwards and hit the third rail?
Oh, I think it was intentional. And as I think you just pointed out, the fact that she didn't stop poking at sort of the foreign policy establishment in Washington with her questioning of Elliot Abrams was probably a good sign that she doesn't intend to give up. I would also just point that with the Elliot Abrams questioning that she did, the thing that was the most fascinating, again, is talking about how the foreign policy establishment in Washington, of which Abrams is a part, is not used to being held accountable, and there is a visceral sort of knee-jerk reaction to want to defend their own. And at least on Twitter, you could see people who otherwise were based at sort of progressive or centrist organizations, such as the Center for American Progress, sending out their tweets defending Elliot Abrams, saying that this is a caricature of the way he's been being portrayed. He's actually a really nice guy, and you know, maybe he's made some mistakes along the way, but he doesn't deserve to be treated like this. All she was doing was calling out some really serious red marks on Abrams' professional history and in his own resume. And I think that the response to what she did with Abrams is probably even more positive than what I'm seeing. As people really appreciate seeing somebody like Abrams being held accountable for once.
Paul, you have any thoughts on whether this was a deliberate attempt to break open the discussion or whether she accidentally stumbled into this hornet's nest?
You know, I don't know either way, really. I guess what I'll say is that I think the reverse has been a deliberate attempt, which is the effort to tar Ilhan Omar as an anti-Semite is a deliberate campaign. Every week since the beginning of the year, I've been getting press releases from the National Republican Congressional Committee, which runs campaigns against House Democrats, calling Ilhan Omar explicitly an anti-Semite. You know, this has been going on. There are two Republican members of the House of Representatives who are Jewish. One of them, Lee Zeldin, has been explicitly calling her out, trying to label her an anti-Semite for weeks ahead of this. And then going back as far as December, Israel operates an app that allows users, people online who want to state their support and defend Israel online, basically like a troll army of volunteers, you know, posted articles about Ilhan Omar that, like, we need to target her and talk back against her because she supports BDS. And they've involved in that is encouraged people to post an article from ACT for America, which is the largest Islamophobic organization in the United States, that attacked Ilhan Omar. So, I mean, this is a deliberate attempt to silence opinion by the Republican Party in an attempt to tar Democrats as anti-Semites, maybe as retribution for the attacks on Representative Steve King for his white supremacy, and also from Israel and its supporters to fight back against the growing support that the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement has in the United States.
All right, Paul Blumenthal of Huffington Post and Eli Clifton of Type Media Center. Thank you both so much for joining us for this part of the discussion. Thanks, guys. Have a great weekend.
Thank you.
Thank you too.
Yes, we've got one last topic to cover, and I want to make sure that we have just enough time to go over what happened this week in the state of the state. And for that, we are joined by Laurel Rosenhall. She covers California politics for the nonprofit news organization Cal Matters. Hi, Laurel. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, good morning. Happy to be here.
Yes, thanks a lot. We know that you're literally on your way because the governor's about to have another press conference. But can you just quickly talk about the fact that the president has declared a state of emergency? Any reason to think that the Attorney General, Javier Becerra, may have standing to sue to stop it? Can you comment on that right quick?
Well, I think that that's the announcement we're about to hear, is they're going to make the case for why they think they do have standing. So we're about to hear from the Attorney General and the Governor any minute now.
Okay. Can you talk about the State of the State address that the Governor made? What are his priorities?
The Governor talked about, he was really trying to, in my opinion, differentiate himself from Jerry Brown. He talked about withdrawing Brown's order to put the National Guard troops on the border. He's rescinding them, moving most of the troops away from the border and up to wildfire areas and areas where they can monitor illegal marijuana grows or enforce that. He also, of course, talks about high-speed rail and the Delta tunnels, and he is laying out a vision that sort of tweaks Jerry Brown's plan. It doesn't completely unravel it, but it definitely is scaling it back.
Okay. And what stood out for you?
You know, what stood out for me was that, Newsom is the first Democrat in more than 100 years to follow a Democrat into the California governor's office. The last several governors that we've had have all been flip-flops in terms of the party. And so it's been very predictable that each one would want to sort of undo the legacy of their predecessor. But now it's a little more of a delicate dance for Newsom, because he does have to sort of honor the legacy of Jerry Brown while also establishing his own path and his own leadership. And so what I saw in this speech was sort of his strongest rhetoric yet in terms of breaking away from Jerry Brown on a number of issues, you know, including the really high-profile issues of the high-speed rail plan, which he said is just not feasible right now under the original vision, but he wants to kind of complete the Central Valley segment of it and then see what happens later. And then the plan for these tunnels to move water through the Delta from Northern California to Southern California, which Jerry Brown had a vision for two tunnels, and Governor Newsom is talking about doing one tunnel.
He seemed to gingerly, you know, deal with the fact that his predecessor was a fellow Democrat, and he seemed to really navigate that carefully. But we have about 2 minutes left to chat with you, Laurel. He unveiled a $209 billion spending plan. So what's next?
Well, the legislature has its sort of budget-making process between now and June, and so we'll see that unfold in a series of hearings, and the governor will sign the budget in June. And meanwhile, you know, the policy process kind of goes through the summer, and we should know in October that's when we'll kind of see the final outcome on all of the various proposals that are coming through as legislation.
And how much cooperation can he expect?
Well, it's one-party rule here in Sacramento. The Democrats have complete control. So there is an expectation that they'll do a lot. The question is always, how much can the Democrats agree with each other? How far will they go in pushing a progressive policy versus, you know, conceding to the more moderate Democrats who are from more swing districts and don't really want to go approving a lot of tax increases or other things that could make them vulnerable in their reelection. So that's always the dynamic up here, and even more so this year with the largest number of Democrats ever in the state legislature.
It'll be interesting, since he won't have that Republican pushback. There won't be anybody to blame if things go south. Laurel Rosenthal, thank you so much for joining us. We can hear you making your way to the next press conference.
Yes.
Thank you so much. We appreciate
it. You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
You bet. That's Laurel Rosenthal. She covers California politics for the nonprofit news organization Cal Matters. They focus on power and personalities in the statehouse. Valuable input there as we look at where California's going. Also, earlier, Paul Blumenthal from the Huffington Post and Eli Clifton from the Type Media Center and Loblog. Thanks all three for helping us on Friday Media Matters. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, go to yourcallradio.org. Malihei Razazan produced today's show. Phil Hartman is the chief engineer. Thank you so much for joining us. I'm Renee Kemp, sitting in for Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.